chapter 15, Jesus tells a series of three parables to explain what the kingdom of heaven is like. And it's not so much the kingdom of heaven, it's the ruler of the kingdom of heaven, and who belongs in the kingdom of heaven, and who doesn't. And the first two are rather self-explanatory. They're very straightforward, if you will, because they're inanimate objects. They're a sheep, and they're a coin. And then it says that he tells the third one. The third one, because there's a particular group of people who are listening. And Jesus is speaking to a group of people who will relate to this, because this father had two sons. Now, some of us refer to this as the parable of the prodigal son. But we studied that last year, and it is not the parable of the prodigal son. It isn't the son that's prodigal in the parable. It's the father that's prodigal. Because prodigal means extravagant. It means wasteful. It means bountifully poured upon. And it's the father that's prodigal. A lot of people think that the father wasted his inheritance on the son, because the son went and wasted it also. But it isn't even the father of the lost son. His sons believed in the older brother because it said all of them were lost. But that's not true. He was lost also because it had nothing to do with geography. It had everything to do with who belonged and who didn't. The difference between the older brother and the younger brother is that the older brother felt he belonged. The older brother was privileged to have belonged because he treated his father's inheritance not the way his little brother does, but he stayed and he remained loyal. And when you get to the conclusion of the parable, both sons have to realize something about the father, that they were both lost because they misunderstood their father. The first son takes the inheritance. And he waits until he doesn't feel he's his son anymore. I wasted your inheritance, Father. So let me come back and be a what? Let me come back and be a servant. That I can do. That I can go to work for you. Maybe I can make up for what I've done. But the first son has to believe that the Father still loves him even after all he's done. The other son has to believe that the father loved him, not because he was like, not unlike the younger son, but that he stayed home and he worked like a toy. Which one has the harder job to do? Which one will faith come easier to? The one who has to believe that his father still loves him, even though there's no reason to, because he waits. Or the other one, trying to believe that the father only loves him because he works for him like his life. And this is how Paul concluded in Romans 9, because he's speaking to a group of people that are a lot like these two sons. He's speaking to a church that's been brought together, church that has been put together out of two groups, these Jewish believers, these believers before they were believers, and then these Gentile believers, God of Israel for the first time, and now all of a sudden they're in the same congregation. And the letter to Romans is writing to both of them. But we told you before that chapters 9, chapter 10, and chapter 11 are all about that first group. They're all about that group who were believers before they were believers. That they were Jews, that they were chosen, that they are the descendants of Abraham, that they are the carriers of the covenant, that they were first. Which makes them best. And Paul's saying, well, if that's the case, then why didn't they believe the Messiah when he was standing right in front of them? And so these three chapters, he wants to take a little opportunity to talk about why, what may have happened to them. What may have happened. And that's how he concludes last week, is that he concludes his own version of the two sons, his own version of these two groups of people. What then are we to say? Gentiles who did not try for righteousness have what? Have attained it. That is righteousness through what? Righteousness through faith. It says the Gentiles have their righteousness because they had no pedigree to make it on, they had no pedigree to build it on, they had no law to keep it from trying to attain it. So they attained it. God said, you who did strive for the righteousness that is based on the law, did not succeed in fulfilling that law. Why not? Because they did not strive for it on the basis of what? On the basis of faith. But as if it were based on works, they have stumbled over the stumbling stone. And actually, they should be praising God that they stumbled over the stumbling stone. The problem is that they don't think that they have. They continue to work and to strive for it based on works and based on the law. And they continue to walk. But Paul's trying to tell them, you continue to walk down this road. I've been down this road. It will take you nowhere. I was on this road. And I was lost. And he's trying to tell them, you need to stumble. You need to live. You need God to get your attention, is what he's telling them. And that's what he said. He's retelling the front, the tale of the lost sons. The older brother cannot admit he needs his father's grace as much as his filthy little brother. Could it be that he even finds shame, maybe, in just believing? Paul says, though, I'm not ashamed. I was the older brother, and I'm not ashamed. But I received faith from the Father the same way that my little brother received faith from the Father. And that is to believe that the Father loves him. And if the Father says that I'm righteous, then all I need to do is believe that I am righteous, and I was. And I am. The older brother, though, continues to find a little bit of shame in that. Morris Benson tells the story of, did you ever live in a town small enough? Or maybe larger, I don't know. It only happened, I only ever saw it in the little town that I grew up in. Because there was always, about once every 5 years, there was a car dealership who wanted to, get some new customers, you know, to find a creative way to advertise. And they would either give away a car to a raffle, or did you ever see a one of those hands-on car giveaways? Which all you needed to do was to be the last person to still have his hand on the car, and you would win. That's all you needed to do. So it's a marathon. They had you put your hand on the car as long as you remained touching the car. If you were still standing, still breathing, still able to put your hand on the car, you would last one, you would win. Well, the story goes that there was a rather wealthy man who said, well, I've got a lot of cars, but I don't have one of those Cadillacs, and I'm going to get a Cadillac. That's all I've got to do. That's what I'm going to do. So he's standing there, and he has his hand on the Cadillac, and all of a sudden he looks around, and there are guys that are trying to do the same thing, and they don't seem to walk in the same social and financial circles. And finally, after about an hour, he looks, and he says, well, if this is the kind of people that you're going to get a Cadillac, he wanted the Cadillac, but he was ashamed to have it what? To have it given to him. And could that be the little bit of Israel's problem? That's what Paul was saying. To Paul, the end is wrong if I say, you know what? This is what's going to happen. I'm speaking to both of you. I'm speaking to Israel. I'm speaking to believers who were believers before they were believers. And I'm speaking to Gentiles, brand new believers. One of these days, you guys are going to begin to collide. In fact, it's my theory that they already have. That's why Romans is written to both of them. That's why he takes time to talk about both of their stations in life and who they are. I believe that their station already happened. I believe the Gentiles are looking at Israel and they're saying, we came to faith. You don't even have it. Paul's chewing you out. He likes us better. And Israel's looking at the Gentiles saying, look, we were first. We're better than this than you are. And Paul's already told them, no. There's no advantage to being what? To being a Jew or a Greek. There's no advantage. no argument anymore. I've got nothing. Whatever I call it, right out of this bed, you're going to call it garbage. In fact, likening it to murder, my pedigree as first, my pedigree as a Jew, my pedigree as a Pharisee, it got me nowhere. I was murdering people and still thinking that I was right with God. So my relationship with the law, my relationship to obedience by works, my relationship to my faith says that I count it all rubbish next to knowing my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. I am not ashamed of God. For it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who would what? Who would believe. So this is where he ends chapter 9, and we come to chapter 10. This is the second installment of the will of what happened in Israel. And again, that's the context in which we find ourselves. He's going to set the context of chapter 10 for us right in the very first verse. He said, brothers and sisters, my heart's desire and prayer for God for them is that they may be what? Is that they may be saved. What's he saying about them right now? He believes they're what? He believes they're lost. For one reason, and one reason alone, there is only one reason that they're lost. That is that they're trying to attain their righteousness through the keeping of the law. That's it. See, some of us read this and we still think that there's an advantage to this. We still think that there is some credit to be had here. And we look and we say, well, that's not bad. Keeping the law is better than not keeping the law. Paul says, not what you're talking about righteousness, is it? Because if there is any bit of iota, a bit of that I think that I'm more righteous than someone else because I'm a little better at the law than they are, he says, not only that, is that not true? He says, I'm wise. Because I will not approach it by faith. I will not approach my righteousness by faith. I'm human, and I will lean on that. I will depend on that one little bit of knowledge about the law. Or coming first, or being first, or having a covenant that you didn't have as a Gentile. So this is how serious this is. Brothers and sisters, my one desire is that they may be what? That they may be mention the very last division of the church is the church of Laodicea. And what does Laodicea call them? They're lukewarm. They're rich and have need of nothing. I've got right doctrine. I have present truth. I have everything I'm supposed to need. I worship on the right day. I eat the right things. I do everything right. I do not need anything. And in that church, it's not a church of Christ. It's a church that has locked Jesus out. He's on the other side of the door, asking to be let in. The other big sign that is the end time is that it says that people love the wax. Apathy is then the biggest sign that we're living in this time. And the reason why apathy is run rampant is because the Church of Christ at the time has locked their love outside. And we try to relate to people through our own righteousness. We end up not witnessing at all. We end up telling people, look, you can be like me, you can be righteous. We don't tell them that we don't have Christ inside the church. But telling people that they can be like us, that they can be right like us, is not the gospel. If the church is willing to live behind its walls without Jesus, then apathy will reign in the world. And when apathy reigns, God will then have proven everything he needed to prove about his love. And about love being in the only way, and in the end, but I don't want to be inside the church that's locking Jesus out. I want to be inside the church that teaches that righteousness comes from a particular way of worship or a particular way of life. I need to be in a church that has opened up the door and allowed Jesus to come in to give us the righteousness that is already paid for. And simply asking us to believe it. That's what we need to be. We need to be enlightened, not ignorant. For Christ is the end of the law. Christ is the end of the law, so that there may be righteousness for everyone in the world who believes this is what's supposed to put us all in the same boat. He's saying you're all in the same boat as sinners. The problem is that half of you didn't believe you were sinners. Because you had something else that the other half didn't have. You had self-righteousness. He said that you were all in the same boat as sinners. Now you're all in the same boat as needing to have faith. He needs to be the end of the law. And it's funny. It's not that the law is ended. Okay, the problem with that is to say that Christ is the end of the law to righteousness. Nay, you might be implying that at one time it was righteousness, but actually Paul is saying it never was. It never was a way of righteousness. So it's not that Christ is the end of the law. The law never was righteousness to anybody. It couldn't be. But that's the way that Paul says it. He's saying it shouldn't be the end now. It should be the end now. Chapter 4. That's why he goes back to Abraham and David. He knows he's going to have these questions. Israel's not saved because they have the law and they can keep the law, and then this new dispensation of grace comes only to Gentiles. He's saying, no, even Abraham and David were saved by righteousness by faith. You say that it couldn't be an end, it never was meant to be an end, and I'll prove it. You know why? Because Moses wrote about it. Moses, how? Moses is the one who wrote it down. The one who was given to by God. He is saying that it never was an end of righteousness. What he quotes here is he quotes Leviticus 16 right here. A person who does these things will live by them. A person who does the law will live by the law. But what's the problem with this, if it's to lead to righteousness, is that nobody has ever done it. director of Pearl Harbor and buy it. Well, I thought about this. David said, no, then we didn't even have to come out before we did. Let me ask you this. Is there any creature more selfish than an individual baby? Wait. Did your baby care how full your bladder was? No. Did your baby care that keeping you in the middle of the night was not the best way to allow you to sleep? No. And for 9 months, did any meal that you ate be your own? No, you had to share it with a little growing parasite, didn't you? So when Moses writes that everyone who will live by the law or keep the law will live by it, he knows what he's talking about. And Paul has already addressed this way back in chapter 3, because when he got in the middle of chapter 3, he wanted us to know that the only way we can be saved is through the blood of Jesus Christ, and that was it. That he was our atoning sacrifice, and he is our righteousness, and that's it. He would be in the church for a chapter and a half to make sure that everybody comes to Christ this way. There is nobody that has any say in any of this. What then? Are we better off? Speaking of Israel, he says, no, not at all. We've already charged that both Jews and Greeks are under the power of sin. As it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who has understanding. There is no one who sees God. All have turned aside. Together they become worthless. There is no one who shows kindness. There's not even one. There is nobody that can perform a good work. Their throats are open to praise, he says. Even our words are defiled. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery are in their path. The way of peace they have not known. The fear of God is nowhere before their eyes. Now we know whatever the law says and speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced. There is nobody in this equation who can open their mouth and claim to have righteousness through the works of the law. Nobody. We all stand before God with our mouths, but closed. We have no testimony. No human being will be justified in his sight by deeds prescribed by the law, for through the law comes the knowledge of the same. And remember, when he finishes that with everybody not able to utter a word when it comes to righteousness, then he says, but now the righteousness of God is going to be. And you all can have it if you simply want to believe. So some look at what Moses wrote in 18:5 at the end there, and they say, yeah, that's me, okay? Because if you look at the, and you look at the context of this, this is the verse that he's holding under 18, not 15, I'm sorry. He says, my ordinances, by doing so, one shall what? One shall live. Paul put it this way, he says, if you're going to try to live by the law, you're going to have to live by the law. Well, verses 1 to 4 says, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. You shall not do as they do in the land of Egypt where you live. You shall not do in the land of Canaan, which I'm bringing you. You will not follow their statutes. There now is the context of that line right there. This is not about righteousness. This is about living better than the nations that are around us. And all of chapter 18 is about sexuality and about procreation. It's about all of these things. Egypt and Canaan. He's going to give guidelines as to how you relate. But it says, moreover, the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants, so that you will love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, in order that you may live. There now. Now we're talking about righteousness based on the law, because he says circumcised not in the flesh, but where? In the heart. Some people ask me, they're going to talk a lot about how Israel coming up the mountain that day. If they had listened to the trumpet and come up the mountain, what would we have done? One of the things I think he would have done was at least to begin to write the law on their hearts and not on the temple. The process would have begun. I told you before, I don't know if they would have been saved. They still needed Jesus. But maybe Jesus would have come a whole lot sooner. And maybe Jesus would have been believed by a whole bunch more people. Had they gone on the mountain that day. And at least listen to what God wanted in mind. And I do know the one thing they wanted was to walk and talk with them the way he walked and talked with Moses. So this is the context. Deuteronomy is Paul's up to quote from Deuteronomy, we'll get to it. It says, surely this commandment I command you today is not too far from you, nor is it far away. It's not in heaven that they should say, who will go up to heaven for us and take it for us so that we may hear it and observe it? Neither is it beyond the sea. And you should say, who will cross to the other side of the sea for us to get it so that we may hear it and observe it? No, the word is very near you. It is in your mouth. It's in your heart for you to observe. He's saying, you don't have to go up to heaven and bring down the sacraments and observe it. You would have to go across the sea and have it written on paper so that someone can teach you how to have a relationship with God. He said, if you believe, you already have a relationship. The word is already in you. This is hard. It only becomes hard for people who insist on having no name. It only becomes hard for people who insist that they will worship the scriptures and not the God of the scriptures described. So that's what Paul is quoting from as he goes on. He says, the righteousness comes from faith. He says, do not send into your heart the world that's in heaven, that is where you Christ at. See, now what should happen? What will happen to Israel right now is that now they're remembering Deuteronomy. They're remembering that the elders stood up in the synagogue, right? And he read from Deuteronomy 30, and we're saying, hold on, wait a minute. Is that what Moses meant? They claim to have the scriptures, but when you only have the scriptures on paper, none of this comes to you. These scriptures do not come to life without Jesus Christ. That's what Paul is saying. Paul says, the only way that I've been able to bring Deuteronomy 30 to life is because I met Jesus on the road to Damascus, and he gave me his righteousness, and I'm not ashamed of that. Who will enter the heaven that is great Christ down? Do I have to go get Jesus and bring him back down in order to have his righteousness right now? Paul says no. Who will enter into the abyss that is great Christ up? Christ isn't in the dead, he's already been raised. He said no. What does it say? The word is near you, on your lips, in your heart. That is the word of faith that we want, that we proclaim. We need to be proclaiming faith. We need to be proclaiming we have no righteousness of our own. We need to be telling people that the gospel is this, that God loves them as much as he loves us. That he doesn't love us because we got there first. That he doesn't love us because we know our Bibles and our scriptures. That he doesn't love us because we've lived a particular lifestyle longer than someone else. The gospel of the should be God loves you as much, if not more, than he loves me. Because I am infuriated. Because every now and then I walk the door and try to walk in my own righteousness. And every now and then he has to try to spew me out of his mouth because I am too lukewarm. So maybe the Gentile who's absolutely cold, freezing, who realizes what they don't even like, maybe he actually loves them more. It's not true. But the context of Joel chapter 2 is this, that it doesn't matter whether or not you live on Mount Zion. It says in the end, everyone will call on the name of the Lord. How many? Everyone. And anyone who will call on the name of the Lord will be what? Will be saved. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem there shall be those who escape, as the Lord has said, and among the survivors shall be those whom the Lord calls. And by the way, whom the Lord called? Everyone. Even on slaves, he said. But how are they to call on one in whom they have not believed? And how are they only to believe in one of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear about someone to proclaim them? Here, now Paul is saying, this is what your witness is, Jews. This is what Israel's witness is. This is where we have fallen short. We need to believe that the gospel that we took out was our own righteousness, that the gospel that we gave people was that you could be right as me. Israel's evangelism was, you're wrong, you're filthy, you're unclean, I'm right, I'm clean, I'm not filthy, you can be like me. How? Here. And we handed tablets with words of your mouth. So we weren't giving them the gospel. We were sending them down the wrong road. And Paul says the reason these Gentiles are not joining the church is not because he gave them the word. Jesus commends the Pharisees for their evangelistic zeal. They go over an entire congregation across the entire ocean to make one convert. And when they do, they make it like the Son of God as you are. Because we still insist that the gospel is about self-righteousness. The gospel is about being righter than somebody else, being cleaner than somebody else. Why? Because I'm not doing it. 8 days. 8 days is all it took in my life to become like my father Abraham. So you see what Paul is up against when he's talking to believers who believe that they're believers before they're believers. How do they get to claim the resurrection? As it's written, how many will live the feet of those who bring good things? That's all I was trying to tell you. It's my mission, my church's mission. If you go away today, not lying to the grace of God. There's one thing that I wanted to happen for you today, that is that you go away not lacking the grace of God. That's good news. If I could do that, I should be able to reach barefoot for you guys, because my feet are beautiful. When you talk about God looking at something and pronouncing nothing, something out of nothing, you'd be talking about my feet. Not all of them may be good news, for Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed our message? For faith comes from what is heard, and what is heard comes through the word of Christ. But I ask, have they not heard? Indeed they were. Indeed they have. For their voices have gone out to all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. But then I ask, did Israel not understand? First Moses says, I'll make you jealous of those who are not a nation. With a foolish nation, I will make you angry. And he's quoting from Deuteronomy 32. They made me jealous with what is of God, provoking with their idols. So I'll make them jealous with what is no people, provoking them with a foolish nation. In other words, Gentiles will believe them when they hear me. Gentiles who did not try it or their will was, will attain it. And now it's come full circle to Deuteronomy. And Isaiah is so bold to say, I've been found by those who did not know, who did not see. I showed myself to those who did not ask for me. Why? Because he's quoting Isaiah 65, and says, I was ready to sought out by those who did not ask, to be found by those who did not see me. I said, here I am, here I am. favorite subject.